Chapter 13. A Plan is Made by Walter Hartwright. On my way back from Pesca's house, I thought of a way to trap the Count and keep myself safe at the same time. I entered the apartment very quietly so that I did not wake up Marion or Laura. Sitting at my desk, I wrote a short letter to Pesca. The man who I showed you at the opera is a member of the Society, and I believe he has gone against that society. Please contact your organisation immediately to check this. You know the name he uses in England, and his address is 5 Forest Road, St John's Wood. If you are reading this, then I have tried and failed to get what I need from him, and I am dead. You have been a very good friend to me, and I ask one last thing of you. Please now do anything you can to finish that man. I signed and dated the letter and put it in an envelope. I wrote the following words on the outside of the envelope. Keep this letter unopened until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. If you do not hear from me or see me by that time, open the letter and read it. Please send a note in return now telling me that you have received this envelope. Then I put it inside another envelope and addressed it to Professor Pesca at his apartment. Once the letter was delivered to Pesca, I would then have some protection. If anything happened to me in the Count's house, I had already made sure that he would pay for it with his life. Next, I went to our landlord, who had a young son. I paid his son to immediately take the letter in a carriage to Pesca's house. About 20 minutes later, the boy returned with a short note from Pesca that stated he had received my letter. I put Pesca's note in my coat pocket and then went into the bedroom to see Laura, who had been my wife for less than a month. I kissed her on her forehead as she lay peacefully sleeping in the bed. I felt more determined than ever to return her identity to her, or die in the final attempt. It was about 11:30 when I got out of a carriage and nervously approached Count Fosco's house. I took out one of my cards and under my name I wrote, "On important private business that cannot wait." I rang the doorbell and waited for a servant to open the door. Then I asked to see the Count and handed the card to the servant, who disappeared back inside. Moments later, I was taken to the sitting room, where the Count himself was sitting in an armchair. A large bag and a box were on the floor next to him. Books, clothes and papers were all over the room. "I can see that you are planning to go on a journey," I said. "I don't know where you are going, but I know why you are leaving." When he heard these words, the Count went to the door, locked it, and then removed the key and put it in his pocket. "Well then, Mr. Hartwright," he said coldly, "tell me what that reason is, if you know it." "I can do better than that. I can show you the reason, if you like," I told him.
"What? How could you show me?" he said.
"Easily," I answered. "Just look at the top of your left arm. You will see it there." The same anxious look of fear came to his face that I had seen in the theatre. He stared into my eyes and said nothing, but his left hand opened a drawer in the table and reached slowly inside it. I heard something heavy being moved in the drawer. It sounded like the thing was metal. "Wait a little," I said as calmly as I could. "The door is locked. You can see I'm not moving and that my hands are empty. I have something more to say." He stared at me with anger in his eyes, but said nothing. I went on. "I want you to read a short note that I have in my pocket." He thought for a moment and then nodded his head. I slowly took out the note from Pesca and handed it to him. He read the note aloud.
"I have received your envelope. If I don't see you before the time you mention, I will open it and read the letter inside it at that exact time."
The Count needed no explanation. He knew immediately who it was from and that I had cleverly protected myself. He took his hand out of the drawer, but left the drawer partly open.
"You are cleverer than I thought, Mr. Hartwright. You have made a trap for me.
So, how long do I have before that letter is opened?"
"Until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, which is enough time for you to do what I need you to do," I told him. "I know that you are guilty of a terrible crime, and I know that you gained £10,000 from it."
I saw anxiety in his face as I said these words.
"Keep the £10,000, I said. "I am not interested in the money. I want two things. Firstly, I want a signed, dated confession from you that states the details of the crime. And secondly, I want proof of the exact date when Lady Glyde left Blackwater Park and travelled to London."
He thought for a moment and then replied,
"Fine, I can write the confession, and I can give you a signed and dated letter written by the late Sir Percival Glyde that mentions the exact date and time that his wife would arrive in London. But I will do these things only if you meet my demands. First, Madame Fosco and I will leave this house freely without you trying to stop us. Second, you will wait here with me until a man I employ, who is coming here to complete some paperwork at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning, arrives. You will give this man a written order to your friend with that envelope, telling him to return the envelope to you here. Third, you will wait here until the envelope safely arrives here and I see it. Then, my wife and I will leave, and you will stay with the man for another half an hour after we have left the house. Those are my demands. Do you agree to them?"
I was shocked at how quick and clever his thinking was. I did not want to allow him to escape, but I wanted the proof of Laura's identity more than anything in the world. So I agreed to his demands.
"Good," he replied. "I will write the confession."
He began to write, sometimes pausing to think and remember. At 4 a.m., he finally put his pen down and stepped away from the desk.
"Done, Mr. Hartwright," he cried brightly
and handed the document to me.
"I think you will be pleased with it."
Then he gave me a letter from Sir Percival Glyde that was dated the 25th of July, which explained that Lady Glyde would be travelling to London by train on the 26th. This was proof, in the Baronet's own handwriting and with his signature, that Lady Glyde was alive on both the 25th and 26th of July. The death certificate stated clearly that Lady Glyde had died on the 25th of July, so here was the evidence that it was not Lady Glyde who had died and been buried at Limeridge. During the next 3 hours, Count Fosco and his wife finished their preparations to leave London. Madame Fosco hardly said anything to me during that time. She just looked at me every now and then with hate in her eyes. At last, 7 o'clock came, and the doorbell rang. I heard a whispered conversation take place in the hall, and then a man with dark hair, who did not look English, came into the room with Count Fosco.
"Mr. Hartwright, meet Mr. Rubel," said the Count.
So this was Mrs. Rubel's husband. I did what I was told and wrote a note to Pesca asking him to give the envelope to the person carrying my note. About an hour later, Mr. Rubel returned with the unopened envelope in his hand. Count Fosco took it from him and burned it, without even opening it to read the letter inside. A few minutes later, Count Fosco and his wife were gone, leaving me alone in the house with Mr. Rubel. Knowing that I had agreed to stay in the house for half an hour longer, I sat down and started to read Count Fosco's confession.